It's just interesting to think about the the representation of someone's work as this collection, really. And actually, it gave me an excuse or an invitation to work on some things that I hadn't been able to just even make concrete, just floating around kind of a much larger project. So this is maybe just one kind of piece of something, I hope. The actual title, because I had to make it into a question, the actual title is Past Performance is Not a Guarantee of Future Returns, and that's an investment jargon. It means basically that, you know, whatever percent you're expecting back, you're not going to necessarily get it. And the subtitle on the collection of experience. So collection is is one of the important terms as a ordering. And actually, this will be the kind of structure of this presentation: a collection as ordering, and collection as act, and what collections do to objects and their relation to commodities and production and experience and commodities, and then other possible orders of the collection. Collection is kind of metaphorically understood. I'll start. Our lives could be called collections of ourselves. Our identities are tangled piles of experiences, memories, facts, narratives, timelines. We order, make chronologies, rank, and label these for a minimum of sanity, as well as tweak them according to specific desires. We relegate to the stacks, or put in the archive, those details we'd be better off to forget. Even without our being conscious of it, this collection documents our sprawling data bodies, which are recovered, reordered, reincarnated by others, even while we're alive. And the term data body is from 1995, a text by Critical Art Ensemble. And what they have to say is that it's, even they're speaking before Edward Snowden, but it's also like goes back to Egyptians and tax collection and getting profiles of everybody. But the accessing and the memory of electronics is what makes it kind of mature. And as artists as a profession, to a certain extent embrace these acts of collation, this gathering, as tools of the trade. The portfolio holds a crucial position as both a collection of accomplishments and as a deliberated insinuation of future performance, what would guarantee of future returns, I guess. The accompanying biography is a tool not only to inventory, but to corroborate the recognition of artistic quality. Order and visibility constitute us as coherent individuals for others to see. Within these lists, projects themselves can divide down into components: forms, contents, and contexts, signatures and references, and then they can also be composed of literal series and sequences, mirroring in our individual administrative capacities the wider compilation around us. For our personal collections are nested inside of other collections, institutions, communities, nations, the world. And in turn, these dig in like edible colonies in our DNA. We are the institution insofar as we accept the banal pragmatism of institutional determination as the logic organizing our value systems. And mood or expression is what maybe you could say a lot of institutional critique takes to heart. That since we're in the system and we can't get out, maybe the only thing we can do is to reflect our own kind of problematic position. You know? And so the line of reasoning curves into a self-fulfilling loop in which the only possibility, as I said, we have is to reflect on our complicity and position in this scheme of things. This much has been summed up by political theorist Gerald Browning from Austria and others in arguments against the cynical or conservative invocations of inescapability and hopelessness that he says afflict the solidifying of so-called second wave institutional critique. To reinvigorate the relevance of critique, Browning advocates flight, exodus, and something called institutional practice without illusions that institutions can be purged wholesale, but with the potential of these measures of flight, exodus, and constituency to deviate from certain structuralization and rigidification. Following this parallel, we can feel the inertia of collection if we're making a parallel between institutions and collections. We can start with the idea of it as an order that you're part of, and maybe think about it more as an act of what actually happens when you're collecting. Just as you can think of constituency as a constant founding of new institutions without becoming, you know, structurally rigid. From the noun of a stable kingdom towards the verb of actively leading the world. We not only fall in line, but we walk the line. Collection, not merely mirroring, is reflexive. Not merely reconfirming the canon, is reconfiguring. But to clarify, in the world I'm writing from and in which you're listening, the realm of the collection is pervaded by commodities. And just as constituent practice alternately faces institutionalization, as you start something new, it turns back into an institution again. Just as maybe second wave institutional critique by people like Andrea Fraser and others, it seems to become an institution. And then isolation, because if you're always running away from the institution, then you might be just talking to yourself, actually. The edge of collection treads is the border between regimes of value because of what is collected has the potential to become a commodity. So on the one hand, when we collect something, we take it out of the circuit of its normal consumption process. The collected object, and even money, which is the means of exchange, once you start collecting money and looking at it as a kind of aesthetic object or for its collection, then it starts to look like fragments of nature. This is how the philosopher Paolo Verno said it, like pinned butterflies. So it's freed from the loop of mundane commodity exchange, and it's lifted to a semiotic and aesthetic sphere where it can be appreciated in itself, like a shell found on a beach. There's a quotation from Jean Baudrillard, who's kind of critical of personal collections as being kind of just confirming the collector's ego. He says, possession cannot apply to an implement since the object I use always directs me back to the world. Rather, it applies to that object once it is divested of its function and made relative to a subject. In this sense, all objects that are possessed submit to the same abstractive operation and participate in a mutual relationship insofar as they refer back to the subject. That's John Baudrillard. So if we believe Baudrillard, it would be more like appreciating ourselves when we collect something. But if we believe someone like Walter Benjamin, it would amount to a more faithful commitment to an object. He said that that a collection only gets its real, its fair, or its the right kind of attention is with the private collector, not a public collection, because of the kind of love or whatever attention. And not even through reading. He's talking about books, sorry. So although we have to be careful, take care in applying this outline wholesale, this idea that you take an object and you remove it from commodity or consumption process, we shouldn't apply that to everything, because, for example, the found natural objects like river stones don't otherwise partake of any specific consumption process. They're just what they are. And artworks are subject to a special type of consumption. They're mostly referred to as exceptional commodities. One artist and writer named Dave Beach, he pointed out that according to neoclassical price theory, which says that the more something is used, the cheaper, or like the less value it has. And with art, the more it's used, actually, the more one. I'll read his quote. Neoclassical price theory assumes that satisfaction, it's actually satisfaction, sorry, satisfaction diminishes with increases in consumption of the same article, but this is not true for art. If looking at art, listening to music, visiting the theater, and reading literature is the kind of experience in which satisfaction, pleasure, and critical acumen accumulates, then it is not true of art that the last increment is small and tends for zero. In art, the last increment tends to be higher than our previous increments. The satisfaction has grown. So, but what kind of connects many of these objects is that in collection, there's a kind of abstraction from context or from there's an abstractive operation. which links them to those economic objects known as commodities, which have been described as anything intended for exchange. And maybe we can return to that definition of a commodity, but for now, it works. And so on the other hand, this shift, the same shift of abstraction from context, is what allows a different sort of exchange to occur and can lead to an object entering or re-entering commodity circulation, playing by different rules. So like the river stone, it wasn't part of that process. It can enter commodity status once if you just try to sell it, first of all, but also when it gets this kind of special status as a collection. Such instability in the social understanding of an object has been addressed in the concept of the commodity potential of all things. That's a quote, sorry. Commodity potential of all things, which seeks to accommodate the biography of an object as it moves between market economies and other societies. It's a term from an anthropologist named Arjun Appadurai. And people have objected to his writing, his text, which is called it's from a book called The Social Life of Things. For example, there's an anthropologist, David Graeber, who says that the emphasis on exchange of commodities and its biography through exchanges tends to make every kind of relation about consumption, and there's no mention of production. Okay, so we'll return to that later. The next part is more about production. Quotation from John Dewey. Generally speaking, John Dewey, if anyone knows, American pragmatist who wrote a book, Art as Experience. Generally speaking, the typical collector is the typical capitalist. The most literal and unselfconscious calculations of art as capital appear in the pop culture tropes of financial markets and auctions, as well as in urban development discourses, and increasingly in neoliberal cultural policy. Art as an asset, first of all, like something that gets traded, even shares of an artwork can be sold and bought, or just simply speculated on. Art is often useful for urban development discourses as something that's good for the neighborhood, good for rent. And increasingly, neoliberal cultural policies is where basically private structures should be responsible for art. But this should be conflated with capitalism. Despite the social and cultural overlaps with an unhinged capitalist society, which has been indicated for a very long time, going back to, for example, Marcuse's affirmative character of culture, or Guy Debord's Society of the Spectacle, more recent celebrity and consumer culture and art's relation to it, and precarization and post-Fordism as where the artist becomes kind of like the model for all production because of being an entrepreneur, being self-employed, being creative, and all these reasons. Recent assessments of art's position relative to capitalist mode of production make a point of refuting the claim that the work of artists is economically capitalist in nature. That's again the The question of whether or not art is a commodity, however, has been turned over and over many times. Its resemblance to the calculability that commodities embody refers to the labor time and investment poured into art practice. And that's from Diedrich Dieterson, the book on surplus value in art, where, you know, if you count art school, if you count like all the extra work that artists do, then all of them, you know, the price is more or less reasonable, usually. And meanwhile, if you think it's unreasonable, then and the seeming absurdity of its inflated price, the price has been observed as closely tied to its apparent suspension beyond calculability value, symbolic value. Symbolic capital, value. And that's more many people have said that. So Isabel Graf, who wrote a book, High Price. As non-wage, non-productive labor, even in its application of manufacturing and studio assistance, and in its manner of consumption, art is wholly exceptional, these arguments say. It is only with the artwork's entry into the commercial gallery that it encounters its first true capitalist operation. It may seem cosmetic or counterintuitive, but it is argued that art's starting point as a commodity and not as capital, even though it's an exceptional one, is what offers an outlet from the cycle of the bottomless accumulation of capital toward a model for exchanges on more mutual grounds. So this forthcoming book for Dave Beach, who I mentioned, it's about the economy of art production, and in his presentation it was interesting that this point for him is kind of like a very positive thing, because you can imagine other economies, commodity to commodity kind of exchanges for art instead of like just money for art for money, or something, you know. CMC versus MCM, as Karl Marx would say. And is it too fast or too slow? Okay. Because of the exceptional nature, not only of the artwork as a commodity, but as practical work, I would like to take it further to the source points for production, which must take a detour through what has been called the emotional situation surrounding work by the philosopher Paolo Virno. Labor, at the expense of time and energy, was always about the collection of money. You work, you collect money. It was kind of like, that's what wage is about. This relation always swung hugely. I mean, obviously, you can have a CEO who earns an incredible amount and a worker who earns less per hour. But at least it found some recourse in what he called the principle of equivalence, which stands at the foundation of the most rigid hierarchies and the most ferocious inequalities, but which guarantees, nonetheless, a certain visibility of social connections, a commensurability, a system of proportionate convertibility. That's his language. You work X amount of hours, you get X amount of money, or, you know, there's some kind of transparency, perhaps. These values, ethical and financial characteristic of a society of work, have been widely upended in the current climate of fear, cynicism, and unlimited insecurity portrayed by Paolo Virno. Correspondingly, value becomes fixed only to an abstract opportunism. So we're always thinking about chances and
the next great idea that might, you know, just might make me a millionaire. The next startup or an app or whatever.
Virno focuses on the most negative and generalized self-disciplinary aspects of this evolution, but the what you could say is a positive perspective, if you can call it that, of abstract opportunism is that celebrated where the disparities in value and distribution potentially present the most reward, as in startups, stock markets, the entertainment industry, and to a certain extent the art world, where you can make something from nothing. The real experience of art practice can be conceived of as somewhere between this feeling of incalculable potential and the difficult working through of materials which aren't quite so adaptive as our own personalities. There is some sympathy found in the writer, critic Diedrich Dietrichson's half-ironic rationalization of artists' constant capital as derived from, quote, unpaid extra time and often informal extra knowledge taken away from other daily activities. His point is that, accounted in a way that more accurately reflects the genesis of artworks, the collection of time congealed in them is, broadly speaking, not as valued, as overvalued as is often presumed, which I said before. But it also alludes to the airy viscera that is gathered through our lives as a collection of material for the purposes of art or not. And this is where I'm choosing to refer to this under-accounted portion in terms of experience. And it's a difficult word, which comprises a field of numerous ambiguities and contestations that spans the history of philosophy, which I'm not prepared to deal with, and I wouldn't add anything really by giving my specific definition. However, I'll give a few specific traits of what experience, what we can think of as experience. we can look and find out where such ideas come from, but for now, I'll just not credit them both. So in the human, experience sits slightly closer to memory than to perception, and it influences both of them, but it's influenced by both, and then it always exceeds our boundaries. It's significant within the discourse about artistic labor because it acknowledges an input and an outside that can't conveniently be subsumed under the terms of production or activity that frame discourses on alienation, which is also a term that is very old, and I won't go too deeply into it. And alienated labor specifically. And to recapitulate a little bit, maybe alienation is watching your labor and leave you, and you have basically no control over it, the results, or even of your relations with other people, and because they are seen as objects, and so. Marx is the kind of more positive word he uses is objectification. And alienation is kind of a perversion of that based on the capitalist production. So it's fair to say that perception, memories, and experiences are retained, and we might even say that they're collected, even in production. From such a point of view, Marx's objectification could potentially be seen as a retention in its positive sense, objectification, which, objectification is from that, a Marxist point of view, is you're working on the world, which is kind of reflecting you back. You're realizing yourself by acting on the world, by objectifying the world. So it could potentially be the retention unto itself of experience. We're going through things and just holding them for ourselves, keeping them for ourselves. But the subsequent abstractive operation of the collection could be how it merges with alienation, how experience might be considered alienated. Could be alien. Some people have kind of rejected the terms of alienation because it kind of makes you. It sounds like there's a natural self that gets then perverted, and it's very fashionable to say there's no self for a very long time, and it's a construction, it's a linguistic, this or that, but. I don't want to enter the debate, really. The nuances between production, collection, experience, alienation, and objectification could be teased out until their tapered ends fit together. Or perhaps the whole thing might be a shadow play inside of the cave of alienation. But I have a hunch there would still be something left hovering like a fly in a laboratory, which would be experience. Experience is the most inscrutable ingredient in commodities. If experiences can't constitute commodities themselves, this is said in spite of experience used in job interviews. Do you have any experience? I mean, in normal language, to denote training and accomplishments, in spite of proposals of an experience economy to supplant the service economy, which is actually following goods and commodities. That some people have arranged it in that kind of historical progression of economies. With Starbucks. Starbucks is held out as the poster child of the experience economy, because you don't actually go to buy a coffee. You're going to have the experience. You're going to have... I'm not going to make an advertisement for Starbucks. In spite of the fact that one's technologically enhanced daily life and social activities generate mountains of financial value and power for a few corporations, as in the concept of the data body, and not only for corporations, but also, of course, governments. What gets in the way is the troubled nature of experience. So are you really actually, are you having an experience at Starbucks? One can get the feeling across, in terms of art, one can get the feeling across a range of work, like photography and documentary, to processes process and duration-based work, where you know you're feeling time, to reference-intensive or remake work, which kind of draws in and takes modernist references and here and there and then make a new artwork out of it, starts with something already valuable. So we can get the sense that experience is there's some kind of literal investment in the experiential in artwork that returns in the value it transmits. And yet experience has long served as the intangible feature of art that escapes capture into commodity form. By the time of Alan Tapper, who was the happenings guy, the only underground avant-garde art, and that's his word, his language, had to be ferreted and hidden to brief, unrepeatable moments, shying away from the publicity of museums and spectacles. That many happenings only happen once, and that was a way to avoid the spectacle for him. Even though he saw that it generated a buzz, but if he kept running, he'd be faster. And Alan Capra was he was very influenced by the writings of the pragmatist John Dewey in his book Art as Experience, where the experiential as the fact of an organism living in an environment comes prior to aesthetic experience. So experience is just happening all the time. And then, as an experience, which then becomes this kind of like a unitary unit somehow. That is, as a whole, that, quote, carries with it its own individualizing quality and self-sufficiency. Dewey's concern was with anchoring aesthetics to everyday perceptions, against idealizing and compartmentalizing views of art that had reached their peak in the modern period. Experience is a factor that runs through an art object in the encounter with material, not only on the kind of thematic level that I referred to before, or the representational kind of stuff. However, with this process of singularization into wholes of aesthetic experiences, we get a sense that there's a kind of abstractive operation happening. The experience is able to leave its context and join us in our memory, which takes on the qualities of the collection. And in his book, you find embedded notions that sound commodity-esque, like transfer values, and artist capital, even. One of his friends is quoted in the book. He ran an educational institution in the United States. And this is his quote. There are in our minds, in solution, a vast number of emotional attitudes, feelings, ready to be re-excited when the proper stimulus arrives. And more than anything else, it is these forms, this residue of experience, which, fuller and richer than in the mind of the ordinary man, constitutes the artist's capital. So, does this indicate that we're just stuck inside the collection because the collection's inside of us? That we can try to walk away from capital, but with each step we just generate more? Following the trauma of World War I, Walter Benjamin had declared the bankruptcy, the poverty of experience. This is moreover restated and elaborated by the Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben, who inserted that not only catastrophe, but even everyday life in any city demonstrated that experience is no longer accessible anymore and can no longer be possessed. Possessed, that's his word. Agamben's narrative traces the descent from a time in antiquity when imagination played a key role in one's psychic life, through to when science had taken on the only possible position of authority in the current age. One's life is a possessable whole, and what you could kind of like pass on to your kids in some way. That idea of life as an experience had been dismantled and rendered accountable to a project of collecting knowledge that indeed can never actually be, there can never be enough of. And science is we can't think of an end of science, really. Despite the seeming depiction of time when we've been fully present to ourselves and now lost, the advantage of Agamben's story is that authentic experience, and it's his word, his term, as he puts it, is not absolute or pure experience, but a critical dilemma split between species and history. So his Agamben, no, I'll, yeah, actually it comes later to explain what that means. In the outlook from both authors points to a sort of jubilee, or like a, you know, general forgiveness of debt, because it's so impoverished. To beginning again, we've reached a point where we have to kind of like start again. But within a history that is always in front of us. In Benjamin's case, he advocated embracing the state of barbarism to which culture had been reduced, seeing poverty as a kind of blank slate. And he even names some examples of what he thinks that is. For example, glass architecture, which doesn't hide anything, and it doesn't try to give you any kind of comfort or warmth. Or, so in a way, Benjamin's a little bit optimistic. For his part, Agamben placed the only window onto authentic experience at the point of infancy, where language meets the ineffable, or what we can't actually put into words, which is not only a developmental state of the individual, but what he calls history's transcendental origin, that one must continuously pass through and seek after. The gap between language and speech becomes the opportunity to intervene in this historically conditioned state of dispossession. And since do I need to clarify that? Can I clarify that? I'll just go on. So what does a beginning look like? In Benjamin's case, emptiness and spareness, state of or a frank renunciation of the accumulated cultural stockpile. And it's kind of like a cold humor regarding tradition or heritage. So just get rid of it. The possessive bourgeois walls are peeled off for the transparency of glass. Collection has defaulted. And the comfort of self-confirmation is wiped of its traces for the stark new. But how does infancy appear, however? Its history cannot be erased, but rather the linguistic means of experience must be a site of continuous struggle. This collection can only resemble a decoding and recoding that pull history along as it works through its means of self-awareness. He talks about how experience being only registered by an ego, by an identity, that can only know itself by its own monologue, its own the way it constructs itself by saying, for example, "I think, therefore I am." That you can't have an experience if you can't put it into words, and I think that's kind of like kind of symptomatic of the late 1970s also, when it was written. And at the same time, it kind of sounds, there's a certain abstraction, because to not be able to put into words something, to always kind of struggle, the only way you can have an authentic experience is to struggle on the point where you can actually give it a name or put it into words. That kind of abstraction may not sound like the Dewey abstraction, where the experience, we have a beginning of an experience and the middle and the end, it arises from kind of our constant experience. It doesn't sound like Dewey experience because it's not concerned with the expression of, as Dewey would say, qualities which all particular objects share, such as color, extensity, solidity, movement, rhythm, etc. Dewey was trying to say that, you know, experience, it doesn't just have to be descriptive. Abstract painting or what have you can also be experience-based because it shares qualities that all other objects share. So abstraction is still kind of connected to the everyday world, at least. But with the Agamben, it is the mystery of the particular object whose capacity to share is the very question, whether we can put it into words to be able to get it across. Whether these, as abstractions, would resemble each other is another story. From this perspective, from Agamben's perspective, and maybe Walter Benjamin, its value must be the subject of intense deliberation. And this sounds like maybe even a bit light compared to someone like Georges Bataille, who wrote about inner experience. And he was claiming that nothing less than the extreme limit of experience, the end of the possible in man, no other value, no other authority, it can't have any other concern or goal than itself. And so transgression was the end of experience, was the actual the point of experience. It could be called experience unless it pushed you to the extreme. His aspirations, Georges Bataille's aspirations, with the mix of passion, despair, and sacrifice, proved impossible for him in his own life, as even his contemporary Jean-Paul Sartre said, who wrote in criticism of his book. For after all, Monsieur Bataille writes, he occupies a position at the Bibliothèque Nationale. He reads, he makes love, he eats. And in short, he participated in a community as well as in a restricted economy. His term, Bataille's term, whose reality could never be sustained by inner experience. Bataille's defenses sounded anything but introverted. He said, "If, as appears to me, a book is a communication, the author is only a link among different readings." Because if people called him on saying, like, "Oh, that doesn't really look like you," and it was kind of, "Oh, it's more of an interpretation." But for me, Bataille's writings had underscored the community's necessity for the value and authority of experience, though perhaps only a community to come. So now we're in a complicated position regarding the question of experience involvement in artwork, and by extension in the production and exchange of commodities, if that's what you consider your work to be. On the one hand, we have poverty, ineffability, hiatus, impossibility. And on the other, we have capital, transferred values, communication, pumpkin spice latte. And maybe we begin to get a sense of the lopsidedness of the whole inquiry. As commodities that are premised on a discourse of desire and consumption, they can only really be positives. They can only give you something. Whereas experience can be, it can come in any imaginable shade of negative. So it can be a feeling of lack. It can be the inability to actually understand, or even the ability to experience is part of it. So art at its most doubtful, pessimist, and alienated is still stranded on the side of the positive, in that sense. Though all its doors may open onto the nature, onto the vastness of experience, which always exceeds it, it's always bigger than the artwork. The limited positiveness of the artwork is, however, it's not only kind of stranded in that ocean of experience. It can reconstruct or call forth particular experiential processes. For example, it can actually point to that kind of negativity, that unattainability of experience in general. Or as Bataille suggested, it can shift the orientation of experience depending on the community it collects. Maybe the question then isn't so much about how abstracted experience gets embodied as value in art objects, but the dialectical tension an artwork can produce within the experiences of its communities. The anthropologist David Graeber, and the reason to bring up anthropologists is because they're looking at the function of a system in a society, so it might help to reflect, for example, on a non-market-based society. So David Graeber pointed to the problem of who I mentioned before, Apadura's position that the commodity is the transcendental category of object, because it can come in and out of market society. He located its formation, Apadura located its formation in exchange as opposed to direction. This is the last page. And its foregrounding, even in gift-giving, the self-interest and calculativeness characteristic of markets. Quote, David Graeber, writing as if all exchanges are simply about things and have nothing to do with making, maintaining, or severing social relationships. In the end, the end result is anthropology as it might have been written by Milton Friedman. So, there's actually no possibility to give someone a gift without this kind of calculating self-interest that where you think, well, what benefit can I get out of it? As I said, in the world I'm writing from, the realm of collection is pervaded by commodities. But we must take care in an age of networks not to assume that by shifting importance onto relation and relationships as opposed to things, our collection bypasses alienation somehow and commodification. This is a time when sharing has lost its innocence, and contacts between people have defined values in a competitive field. But it would be a very contemporary mistake to assign an irreversible causal role to commodities as that which brings the collection into being. So, and if we bring the relation back to what to Marx, objectification versus alienation, The effect of conflating, this is a quotation from somebody. You can come up to me afterwards if you want. The effect of conflating the distinction is a misreading of Marx, the distinction between objectification and alienation. The effect of conflating this distinction is a misreading of Marx that enables the category of labor historically peculiar to capitalism to operate ontologically. The very thing Marx wished to combat. So, like, all work is... makes Jack a dull boy, right? But Marx actually work is part of man's self-realization. So it's not it's the apple spoiling the rotten apple spoiling the basket, or however to say. But okay, so. A different classification system of the collection. Maybe that's what we need. What's the order that keeps this collection together? It could take many forms. For example, indexed along the lines of politicized autonomy, or premised on the right to insolvency, the right to be in debt and not pay your debts back, or configured according to the pleasures of pure creative potential. Those three are from just trying to pick when I'm thinking about, okay, how could experience still be about sharing with other people and not take on and enter artworks, but not just take on this quality of commodity exchange and kind of self-interested worldview. Those are other people's ideas. So, like, for example, on autonomy, we can imagine, we can think about like the social, the role of collection as a social reproduction rather than it accumulating wealth in something like the peasant movement where they save seeds and the whole tradition of giving that, of keeping their community kind of self-sufficient and autonomous is realized through collecting, which is interesting. This idea of insolvency is from a recent book by Franco Bifo Girardi, which kind of tracks how language and debt have kind of been lumped together somehow, because, for example, the financial industries have captured language to such a degree that it's not actually real things, but just acts of language that, for example, put a whole country into debt. And his book what I mean is that just some stockbrokers can like change the definition of a whole economic system by these strange, very linguistic kind of operations that define and operate in the financial industry. He's saying, let's just not pay it back. I mean, it's kind of like the message of Occupy movements everywhere. And David Graeber, the term pure creative potential is from David Graeber. in his book, the toward an anthropological theory of value, trying to think about what actually is the value system of a non-market economy, of a non-capitalist economy. Some of them operate more on maximizing creative potential, the ability of a person, of a leader, to bring their people into being, and for the people to agree to that is not simply through force, but through, of course, very specific cultural formations of mythology or other things that kind of create community. But I simply don't have the word for what the grounds and conditions for authentic experiences would be. So maybe that's a new experience. And that would be my conclusion. Thank you. It was written for reading, so I hope it was not so long. It was understanding.
I have a question. I'm wondering what you're thinking about. I was kind of looking at the videos while you were talking and trying to think about how you, I'm curious how you think about image making, like in terms of photography or video, both as a presentational tool or a documentary tool. How you imagine that working within this kind of experience economy? Because on the one hand, it does have this function of abstracting something out of its context, that then maybe, as you said, at some point, opens it up to the possibility to a more easier objectification. But at the same time, it may also be able to allow us to enter that kind of point of infancy, maybe like that gap between.
What specific representation?
No, just for example.
Like photo based stuff?
Photo based stuff. Like how.
Well, actually, I mean, Giorgio Agamben, when he talks about that, what the authentic experience could be being where language meets what it can't put into language. To me, it sounds like he's talking about art to some degree. But yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it can, but the problem is if then we're talking about art. We're talking about the production of art and like all this stuff that it's part of. And if we think about art as a labor producing commodities, then that very simple kind of experimentation, it's kind of compromised, I think. It's not simply about kind of exploring. It's not simply about expanding the limits of language and of the ability to experience. It's part of the whole thing. So that's why, and I don't know if this is the best way to finish, like those three possibilities that I kind of tried to hint at are all more social understandings of how experience could be collected and shared in a not as commodities, not as kind of capitalization somehow. Does that mean we all have to make very loud political art or something, or can we still kind of work within our frame, expanding the language and find some some other more equitable way to share these things. I think for me that's what could be a question or a direction. I don't know if that's your question.
Mm-hmm. But this does come out of an anxiety around the possibilities of sharing experience. Is that
partly it's maybe or that thinking all of your experiences have some value that you can calculate, which feels like everyday life actually.
Mm-hmm.
But is the video? Of course, we try to understand why the video is.
Oh, I should have said something.
And is the video something that you think is doing or trying to do what you want to do?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, I just thought maybe it'd be nice to look at something for people instead of just me. So. Was it distracting?
Well, if you show an image while somebody's talking, of course you try to make a link in between.
Well,
especially if the video is silent, we're very used to kind of connect things.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course,
it's a good point. I mean, for me, the connection is that that it is kind of artwork form somehow, but I mean, maybe it's just to have something to look at, really. But the video was made in Japan, where I've been living, so that I explain that there's not really a relation. The inside of a commercial sign above a supermarket, and it's called Stakeout. One day, over several days, taking kind of pictures from inside that sign to the customers of the supermarket, and then pasting their pictures back up, and then that process of kind of like comparing these people to these other images. I think we can certainly talk about images and daily life and value, surveillance, these kind of things, which I touched on, but it wasn't meant to kind of demonstrate a successful non-capitalized experience.
One thing that, when you were reading Rare, he talks a lot about Marcel Mauss, and then the idea of a gift economy where you have if you have a situation, you're trying to open a relationship, and I give you $5, then our relationship's open. But if you give me $5, then it's closed. If I give you something that you can return, but you can't exactly return.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Then all of a sudden,
less or more value.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then you don't really know. And then there's this system of trying to understand how what our standing is.
Yeah.
And so then you have, like, if you go to the supermarket and you buy milk and give it to somebody else, then within the world of objects, then it's more confusing and it's more socially, like, engaging, I guess, in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, obviously, John was actually, who I wrote the text for, he's a little uncomfortable with the anthropology there, because he's as if, like, we've found a good model or something, which you can't just, like, take that and apply it necessarily. But also, yeah, of course, this kind of, like, this gaming between people about who gives the bigger gift is, and stuff like that, it also happens. And it's not, who's to say that that's kind of, like, a better system than,
right,
than, like, capitalism?
Or these halfway objects where, like, everybody's aware exactly how expensive something is, so it's just, like, a declaration of your...
But David Graeber, I mean, the reason he's interesting, I think, to bring him in is because he is writing to somehow apply these ideas. It's not, he's also referring to the history of anthropology being very related to not only the colonialism, but to when people were trying to, when there were so many revolutions going on and constitutions being written, like, what other models are there? And so, like, that's actually part of anthropology's history, that we look elsewhere to reflect on our own. So that's what I told Jonah. He let me keep it. Also, John, I left a kind of light on the parallel to institutional critique, because the example that Gerald Rauner, this guy who's talking about, I can have a show of baby pictures. The reason the example that he's bringing up, it's always bad to, I mean, it's always kind of hard to have an example. His example of constituent practices is this, of a practice of constantly instituting, where you'd never kind of form into an institution. His example is this group, or this project from Hamburg called Park Fiction. And again, John said that in his writing, he doesn't refer to the problems of group work. And it's just kind of idealizing this fuzzy hippie stuff.
But Ronnie is also bluntly saying that he's using art for revolutionary purpose. I mean, he's totally being okay for art being instrumentalized. So I don't know how far it is. It's a contradiction with the idea of pure authentic experience or creative pure authentic. So,
well, yeah, he wasn't talking about experience at all.
No, but you brought them together somehow. And I don't know much about drawing being here at that point.
The reason I brought him in was because if we think of that all we can do is produce commodities, that all we can do is position ourselves as producers of commodities. Actually, it sounds very much like these some proponents of institutional critique. To me, maybe I mean, like for example, sleeping with a collector. You show your relationship to selling your body as an artistic act, and the kind of like surplus value of that is your self-critique somehow, and also like the a lot that because Isabel Ruff was my teacher, and I absorbed so much of that kind of idea that you know, like the reference to being sold in the artwork is like the ultimate artistic act in some way, as opposed to maybe setting something up or running away, or you know, this is what I appreciate about Browning's, what he has to say, because I just don't think that's all there is to it. I don't think all we can do is make a self-critical commodity. Argue? But what could be, yeah. What could that be, really?
There's that list that, I don't know what it is, but when a graduate student made a list of activities that are either consuming or producing, like taking a shower, or it's just non-binary. I don't know if that, like, what's the name, but it just reminds me of those.
Mm. Also, yeah, there's several holes in this. One, I think, is having just keeping it to yourself. I mean, how does that fit in here? You have a shower or whatever. You have an experience. You are a hermit. I think it's just when it'd be nice to think that we can make art without necessarily adding to that to the argument that all we can do is make commodities and capitalize on them. And use whatever kind of relations we have with other people as the sources for that, and many friendships broke up that way.
I have more comment than a question, because we're always mentioning collectors and collecting. I mean, and it seems that the gist of your argument pertains to a certain critique of political economy, and
which economy?
Critique of political economy, certain Marxism, and it seems that there is an easy path or a short path to try to reestablish the rights of authentic experience, and that would be quite rhetorically to say that the best way to undermine this only political gesture that is collecting in its specific condition of capitalism is to put the emphasis on recollection. And that is what a certain type of philosophical anthropology, which goes from Benjamin through Foucault to Agamben, defense, that is, capitalist subject or the individual as subjective, right? Capitalist processes of circulation is the individual par excellence, who is not able anymore to perform those processes of recollection of one's experience because of the scattered life, because of flexibility brought about by the conditions of post-modernist work. And
did you say able or not able?
Not able.
Not able to recollect.
Yeah, not able to recollect. But this is still, I think, slightly decentralizing. This is, this trend of closed-door anthropology go from Benjamin Closed-door to Dragon Den. There's emphasis on techniques of the self. But I think that I see it from another perspective, because I still see from a very philosophical point of view all the dilemmas we're going to run into if we still play the game of authenticity or essentialism as regards experience. This is something that has obsessed the logical positivists, Carla, at the first rank at the beginning of the 20th century. And if we think of it in terms of, strictly in terms of critique of political economy, and if we think of experience as this great book by Edmond Leboutin called Cognitive Capitalism, where he talks about experience in the terms in which you define it, where he speaks of it in terms of non-codifiable immaterials. So all the knowledges that have to do, know-hows that have to do with care, the healthcare system, everything that doesn't have to do with strict reproduction of the conditions of production, and the conditions of production, so care, know-hows on the workplace that doesn't have to do with like official routines and creative labor in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, it shows a lot more anthropological realism than trying to reach for this kind of, LA's point or something that would be like a ground where the experience would be more authentic. And Moulin Mouton is actually defending, it's quite a reformist project, that universal revenue on this basis. So, it's like killing two birds with one stone, because universal revenue warrants, for example, artists who are precarious workers, dozens of them, to do their stuff without this kind of impoverishment of their own experience, having to grants and go from one residency to another. I still think that, to be very provocative, I would say that again it's capital against labor, and the rest is probably beneath the So I would be more keen on grounding those arguments in the critique of political economy than trying to look at the history of philosophy and say, okay, where do we have the most acute description of what is essential or authentic experience? Right.
Acute?
Maybe it's not the right word. Authenticity was the word you used.
That was definitely a trouble. I don't know if this is exactly the kind of linchpin of what you're saying, but the authenticity is a problem to put it in that way, to like seek for authenticity. But it's not like that type of, I was using the word because the way Giorgio Agamben used it. And it's not like this self-possessed meaning, but how do you start to kind of think about these questions when somebody has already said it's no longer accessible, it's no longer possessible to have an experience? And I see in his own wording of it that authentic experience is not like this authentic thing, but it's this always an encounter with something other that you can't, it's ineffable.
Right. Is that what, like when you, because you bring up language then as the ineffable and everything else being language, like something Wittgenstein away. But like playing with that memory and experience being maybe on the intersection between those things in a way. Because it seems like it just turns language around.
I'm not comfortable with the idea that everything is just language, really. I find that Agamben saying we can't have an experience until it's put into words. I find that a little maybe we can start a bit farther back. I think babies and children have experiences before they can talk, but there's a lot of people who have taken issue with that, I think. And
but it also agrees with what you're saying about memory, sorry, memory and experience being more related than perception and experience. But I feel like the transition is to understanding how language is relative is sort of for me to.
I mean, it's the way that things get across. It's the tool also. It's not just for yourself, but also maybe interesting to put it in relation to information as opposed to experience, where information is this thing that is basically, I think it's what Berardi is really arguing against, that all of our interactions with the world becoming, or social interactions becoming kind of just these units of information, and generating it and kind of being affected by it, and then it's being controlled a lot by just how capital moves. I think it's harder to capture experience in that way. There's a lot that's not worth anything, and actually that's one interesting thing for me to keep thinking about. But also, somehow making an artwork out of an incredibly negative experience for oneself can be the only value you can get from a negative experience. I thought that was interesting, I couldn't put it in because it kind of points in a different direction that we're talking about, kind of subjectivity, self-knowledge, and one's own story, value for oneself. But to return to what you said, does that you have to have a pretty strong state for what is it called? Total
universal revenue.
Universal revenue?
Yeah, sure. That's the big question in the Marxist tradition.
But how can we get there? But how can artists help that?
How can artists help that?
Yeah, for example,
I have very crooked answer, maybe the economists who the Marxist ones.
Yeah, it's not. Artists are not the most important, sure.
shall we leave it at that and then go onwards to more experiences outside of here?
You're not allowed to use that word anymore.
Okay. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.